needs this, huh? Welcome to Dinner Theater, friends. Our performance tonight is entitled Who Needs Us, as you've heard. It's going to be in two scenes. Scene one, the parish. Scene two, the world. But before I get to that, I've been instructed to read the following announcement. George Anderson is a wholly owned subsidiary of Luther College, a four-year liberal arts college enthusiastically related to the American Lutheran Church and located in scenic, temptation-free Decorah, Iowa. Some of you have been there, I guess, huh? If you know of qualified students who do not, for some reason, want to go to PLU or LBI, tell them that Luther College is now accepting applications for the fall of 1983. Thank you. Now this evening, we want to talk... That was the only reason they would let me get away for a week, was if I made this announcement. So I've done the commercial, now I can do the entertainment. Tonight, I want to ask you to put on a special pair of spectacles. You know that there are glasses now that will combine two images so that you can get a 3D version of a movie or television even. I'm going to suggest tonight that you put on a kind of bifocals that will split up the congregation with which you're associated, either as pastor or member, and or as a person working in the parish. Divide this up so that we look at your congregation for a moment as two congregations. It's a simple little analytic tool, but it may help us in understanding something about ministry, both in terms of ministry in the parish and also in terms of ministry to the wider world. Now, we've got to have names for this division that we're going to make in the parish, and I'm going to suggest that we consider, first of all, what happens if you are a pastor and a congregation calls you. You usually are waited upon by a group of persons from the congregation, and they will talk to you and interpret to you the life of the congregation, tell you something about it, its potential, its need for ministry, and so on. And in meeting that group, you have met a small segment of what I would call the nuclear congregation. That is, those are the people that are there for almost everything that goes on. They're willing to support the program fully. They're probably your church council members. They're the officers of the congregation, the auxiliaries. They will come if you have a service on Ascension Day, for example. They will, some of them will show up at least. They are the pillars of the congregation, the nucleus, and for short, we'll simply refer to them as Congregation A. Then there is another group. And these are the people that come at Christmas and Easter that don't show up very often, are irregular in their contribution, probably are not on active committee work, although sometimes their names do appear on committee lists. They are the great cloud of witnesses referred to in Hebrews. They tend to refer to the congregation as they. And we will refer to them as the peripheral congregation or Congregation B. That is the group which, when you're a member of the when you're a pastor of the congregation, you normally refer to as the dead wood. When you are coming to a congregation, they are usually referred to as the potential in the congregation. When that call committee came to you and said, "This congregation has great potential," they simply meant that there are a lot of folks in Congregation B. And as a matter of fact, as you talk with the committee about the congregation, you begin to say, yes, it sounds indeed as though you do have potential there. And you tell yourself afterwards, or your husband, or your wife, depending on whether you're female or male pastor, you say, "I think I'm going to take that call because what they really need is," and you can fill in the blank, "strong preaching or caring ministry or a real challenge, or a person like me," whatever it happens to be. And if, you know, if I go there, I think, Lord willing and through the power of his help, I think we can really do something fine in that congregation. And so you go and thereby sign a kind of contract that you will indeed bring in more of Congregation B and make them active as part of Congregation A. And by golly, it happens. Third Sunday you're there, some member of the council sidles up to you afterwards and says, "It's happening." And you, of course... being somewhat paranoid at that point, you jump a bit and say, what? And it says something like this: "There's some faces out there that haven't been there for about 3 years. They're coming back." And you think of those passages from the Psalms about them streaming to Mount Zion and begin to think, at last you found the parish that's really going to suit your kind of ministry. Now, what they didn't tell you was, because they didn't think it was important, one of the ushers said to another usher that same morning, "Ed, Mabel and I probably won't be here next Sunday, so you'll have to get somebody to usher for me." And Ed said, "Why, Charlie, you haven't missed a day of ushering in 3 years." "Well, I know," he said, "but you know, Mabel's mother isn't any too well, and we like to get up and see her once in a while, and it's just getting too much to drive back every Saturday night. So we've got the place up there in the mountains, and we're just going to stop there on the way home and take a few weekends. Now, I don't mean I don't want to be usher anymore, but just don't count on me every Sunday." Well, they don't say that to the pastor because they don't think it's significant. But in fact, a process has started that goes on in every parish whenever there's a change of ministry. That is that certain people began to feel either that now they have a place in that congregation's inner life, inner circle, or they begin to feel that for one reason or another, it may have nothing to do with the pastor, it may be that simply loyalty to the former person has kept them coming long beyond the time that they normally would have continued such activity. And they feel no such allegiance to Pastor X, who's just come. And therefore, they begin to slip a bit and begin to put other things into the schedule, the very busy schedule that they have. And you, if you've been in such a parish and begun to visit people, you can almost do a test bore right down through the congregation and all its levels, because as you go around, you know how it is. You come into a house and they'll say, "Oh, hello, Pastor. So glad you're here. Now, we want you to just feel at home. Come anytime. Pastor Y, your predecessor, was just like one of the family. She just would come in and sit down and pour herself a cup of coffee, and we just made nothing of her at all. She was just part of the folks. We want you to be the same way. Just drop in anytime." You leave and make a little note in your book: "Whenever I go to the Carlsons, take off my shoes, pour myself a cup of coffee." What they expect. So then you go on down the block to the Olsons, and you knock on the door, and you say, "Hello, I'm Pastor X from Holy Trinity." And they say, "Oh, what happened to Pastor Y?" You know you've moved out into Congregation B. And then, of course, you may get to the Larsons, and you knock on the door and you say, "I'm Pastor X from Holy Trinity," and they look at you and say, "Oh, yeah, well, come on in." You know that kind of "come on in" that sort of sounds like, are you really going to read the meter, or why have you, what are you here for? And so you sit down, and then this very tentative conversation begins, and it's clear that they never even knew about Pastor Y. And they're really trying to figure out whether you're new or whether you've been there a long time, and it's this tentative sort of probing, and they'll usually start with their confirmation. They'll say something about, you know, "Pastor Z was a great man. We went to confirmation for him for 3 years. Used to meet down in the basement of the church." And, they'll go on like this for 15, 20 minutes until You know, you hear from them, they'll say something. Well, he was a great man. He was really active in community affairs. Anything went on in this town, he was right there. He was on every committee in the Red Cross and United Way, and really a great community figure. What do you do, Pastor? Well, you can see what happens. What we're dealing with in any change of pastorate is a process which I guess sociologically is simply called recontracting. Persons have a loyalty to the congregation, and they also have a particular way of relating to the pastor. And they expect certain things of us or them. And as they do this, we tend to try and as much as possible to fulfill those needs, whatever they are, whether it's a need to be the image of the congregation in the wider community, or a strong preacher, or a good visitor. We are such sort of compulsive folks that we really try to provide everybody with what they need. Now, I'm going to suggest that, of course, that's difficult and downright impossible, and that it might help us a lot if, in looking at our relationships within the parish, we try to see that the needs of Congregation A and Congregation B are really very different. And that if we can meet them on their level, that is, if we can provide them the kind of ministry they want and need, we will indeed be useful to them, helpful to them, and will spare ourselves a lot of pain and waste motion. I want to look at an example from each of those congregations. I want to look at A first for a moment. Congregation A is usually made up of persons who are bound to each other, not just through the pastor, but through all kinds of family ties, friendships, marriage, long-standing social relationships of one sort and another. And they're active, not just because of their commitment to Jesus Christ, but also because of very human factors involved. They like each other's company, they like some of the other folks in that inner nucleus. There are tensions there as well. And one of the things the pastor discovers is that these people expect more than just word from you. They want presence. They want a ministry of presence. They want you to be at their family celebrations. They want you to be a part of activities. You want you to be visible, perhaps in their home or at their hospital bedside. They expect your presence and your involvement. And we're used to giving that, so that's not so difficult. But along with that strong emotional bond, you have in a nucleus always tremendous nuclear forces. And that means you have high emotional levels and high involvement vectors there. And therefore, when strains begin to develop, the pressures build up, and the crisis that can occur within the nucleus can indeed sometimes result in, if you take the analogy, we're talking about a nucleus here, there is such a thing as nuclear fission. And when that occurs, there's usually a tremendous explosion, a great amount of heat, and sometimes a particle is emitted at high speed. Sometimes that's the pastor. And sometimes it's the church treasurer. About 30 months into any ministry, you can expect that those forces will have built to the point where that nuclear congregation now must come to terms with the new ministry. They can no longer avoid it or say, well, you know, give her a few more weeks and she'll understand how we operate. Or, you know, this guy's the craziest person we ever had. We're going to have to see if we can get somebody else quick. Well, after three years, 30 months or so, they begin to discover that probably you're going to stay for a while and you're going to be you and not Y or Z. And as that pressure builds up then, there is going to come this showdown at the OK Corral. And it'll usually be some council meeting, and it'll usually come up on an issue not at all related to what really is at stake. Because what really is at stake is simply somebody's place in that nucleus. Somebody who had a significant role and suddenly begins to discover that that's no longer so important. And that role, as it declines, hurts. They don't know quite how to express it, and they see it in all kinds of other ways. But it will come out. There will be an explosion. Now, all I'm saying here is that as pastor or as minister or as council member, in that context, or as spouse of a pastor, to know that what's happening is not necessarily a function of the two personalities. That is, it's not that you're failing in your ministry or that that church treasurer has a forehead of iron and a neck of brass, but that you are both human beings and that it's almost inevitable that in that restructuring of a congregation for a new ministry, such a crisis is about to occur. And if you know that, then it's possible to minister through it. That is, to be pastor through the crisis. Be pastor to that hurting person who is so mad at you or at something that she or he cannot really enunciate or say what's hurting. But if you know that, perhaps it's possible for you to carry through, to support, and to understand, even if it means the loss of that member. But in fact, it may not, because one party to that conflict may be able to understand what's going on. Well, that's just an example of the kind of dynamics that go on in Congregation A. Now, I'm speaking basically of pastor. The whole process goes much more rapidly if there's a second staff member involved. The second staff member situation, that crisis often comes, well, the first little bump comes about four months in, I'm going to say 4 minutes, 4 months into the staff relationship. And someone has described that as a pinch point. I think John Scher, as a matter of fact, over in Spokane has used that term for that particular point in the staff relationship. But then about a year or so, the same kind of crisis occurs. And of course, it can all be speeded up if the assistant drives a motorcycle or something like that. And the persons can get very excited very early. But just in ordinary circumstances, about a year into the ministry, that same kind of thing happens. Of course, here it's complicated because it may happen between assistant and pastor, or it may happen between assistant and congregation. But again, it's a nuclear phenomenon. That it comes about among that group of people who must work together tightly and from whom a high level of emotional commitment is virtually demanded. Okay, that's the sort of thing that goes on in the nucleus. And I simply give an example of how people need us in the nucleus. That is, they need, as I say, a ministry of presence, but they also need the understanding that the kinds of stresses that are occurring in their lives as they try to adjust to a new pastorate are not unusual, and that one can work through that crisis with individuals. Now let's look at Congregation B. Here I want to use another example, this one from evangelism. Because, as I've said, Congregation B is often seen now as the prime target for evangelistic activity. You decide you're going to have an evangelistic program, you get folks together, you divide them up in groups of two, and you give them a list of people. Now, who are those people? They tend to be folks who are out there in Congregation B. And you send them out two by two to call on those people and to present to them the work of the church and the challenge to become more active in the congregation. That all seems so logical from our point of view there in Congregation A. Here we are, 100% committed or 110% committed, and there are those folks out there who really aren't that much involved. So let's us go out and invite them to get active. But think for a minute how it looks to folks in Congregation B. It's really a kind of a put-down, because no matter how you say it or how you put it, you're coming out and saying to them, or callers are coming out and saying to them, why don't you folks shape up and be like we are? We put it very kindly, and we very enthusiastically, and so on. But the message is clear. And think for a minute the little drama that goes on there in that suburban house when the car pulls up in front, you know. George looks out the window through the Venetian blinds. He says, hey, Martha, it's them from the church again. Must be November. Says, you go in the kitchen and make some coffee, and I'll take care of them in the living room. So they come knock on the door and come in. Hello, we're from Holy Trinity Lutheran Church. We'd like to sit down and talk to you for a while. Sure, come right in. Sit down. So they do. They get out their brochure or their yearbook, whatever they happen to be bringing along, and they say, "We'd like to tell a little bit about the congregation." Right, sure. And they go through their thing, and when that's over, then he says, "Anybody ever tell you why we don't go to church there anymore?" "No," they say. "Well, let me tell you." And then there follows a narrative of a confidence betrayed, or a slight which was never recognized, or a battle over a carpet which turned out to be the wrong color, or a relative who was not given proper care at a proper crisis, or at a crisis in the life. A litany of charges against those folks down there. And finally, if we can just look at the scene, you know, half an hour later, the door opens and two shaken visitors come walking out to the car, and they sit down in the car and grab their little report sheet and write, "This is one the pastor better check on." Now, you know, sure, we could sit here and chuckle about that, but isn't it all too human? I mean, it's been a game of one-upsmanship. Folks, George and Martha sitting there in that house, see the folks coming. They've come every year, same kind of message. Come on, shape up, get active. And what do? They respond in the way they know best. They respond by saying, "There are good reasons for us not being active." They get defensive, in other words, and they put up their argument. They haul out their hurt and display it all quivering there for everybody to see for a while, and then send the folks away, and the folks go away properly chastened by having discovered this terrible tragedy which had occurred in the congregation 5 or 7 years before, perhaps. Now, what do you do then about folks in congregation B? Well, I'm suggesting that maybe the way to deal with them is not to see them as evangelism targets in that sense, but to see that they have needs from the congregation, but they're different needs. Congregation A, the inner group, says in essence, "Because you are the pastor, I will call on you when I need you and expect you to be there." Ministry of presence. Congregation B really wants to say, "Since you were there when I called on you and needed you, you will become my pastor." And I think all of you had experiences of going into a new congregation, discovering a couple or a family that has perhaps first become strongly active, may have been a family to whom you had to provide some crisis pastoral services within your first few weeks of ministry. That is, they discovered in you a pastor who was available when they needed that service. And because of that, they then now become a part of the congregation, a much more active part of the congregation. I'm suggesting, in other words, that those things that we do all the time and worry so much about because it seems to take a lot of time, you know, the funeral of the second cousin of somebody who once was a member of the congregation but moved away and nobody else knew who to call. Worry about those kinds of things sometimes and don't know quite what to say. It's difficult to minister in such circumstances. Nevertheless, it's that kind of ministry of availability that is perhaps the most helpful and ultimately the most useful and fruitful to people in Congregation B. It is because they find that folks in Congregation A, it may not be the pastor, but somebody else, is there when they need, responds when they call, that it's likely they will then respond with a more elevated interest and energy level. Now, of course, this is not true all the time, but I'm just proposing for a moment that instead of our usual picture of saying the main job is to get everybody in B into A, we say we have a certain ministry to that nuclear group, and then we have a different sort of ministry to the outer group. Both of them are valid. Both of them perhaps are at the level at which persons at that point are able to receive ministry. Because another way of looking at people in Congregation B is saying they are essentially trapped by various things. They may be trapped by family circumstances where it's difficult for them to attend regularly. or by emotional circumstances, there has been a slight or a hurt that they have not been able to get over, or a pride that they have not been able to release themselves from so they could come back. There may be, in other words, they may be in various sorts of bondage in Congregation B. And that our way of dealing with it is not to treat them as essentially well people who can simply make a choice as to whether or not they will come next Sunday, but to try to find out how we can assist them to break whatever bondage may be holding them. And that breaking the bondage may not mean that they can come regularly. It may mean only that we're able to minister to them in their difficulty. We have, for example, no compunction usually about sending the church bulletin to college students because they are away. They're physically unable to attend, or persons in military service. Well, I'm suggesting there are people who live right close to the church who are also, for one reason or another, physically unable to attend. Not because of infirmity, but because of something in their lives that simply can't allow them yet to traverse that space into the congregation. And therefore, we still care and are concerned about them, but not in the way of the typical evangelism, shape up and join us kind of approach. But this is the last point I want to make on the parish. Let's also remember that it is not likely that we are going to ever bring that whole Congregation B into what I'm calling now 100% highly active status as Congregation A. In fact, if you look at a congregation through its life, you will see that what happens is that congregation, it's kind of like a graveyard around a rural church. The older the congregation, the larger the graveyard. Well, the older the congregation, the larger Congregation B tends to become. A mission church, everybody's active. Everybody's there virtually every Sunday. And you know how that goes. If somebody misses, there's a phone call. Hey, why weren't you folks here last Sunday? Gee, we really missed you. And they really feel badly because everybody's got to pitch in and get the place going. Then you organize. Huh? And then, almost immediately, there gets to be that little dotted line around the inner circle. And there are a few folks who aren't quite so active anymore. And you begin to get the new folks versus the old folks, you know. Wow, they weren't here when we were going through the time in that house church, you know. They come in later. And you begin to get that difference. And so, gradually, that circle begins to get bigger. And then you get people go away to college, you get people who move away, and as congregations grow and get older, that B congregation enlarges. And I'm simply saying that's likely always to be the case. And instead of knocking yourself out or feeling somehow that you're not doing the Lord's work because they're not all that active, perhaps it's helpful and healthy to say, I have two congregations, and I'll minister to those two in different ways. And the other thing is important, then, is to help the counselor, those who are also strategizing for the congregation, to understand that Congregation B exists, and it will probably always exist, and that there are some people now in Congregation A who will float out there, maybe for the balance of your ministry, kind of in a holding pattern. But as soon as someone else comes, perhaps they can reactivate them. But conversely, others then will float out as well. There's a kind of constant convection that goes on between the two cells. Okay, that's tries to say something about who needs us, what people need us for within the congregation. But the reason I've gone to all this length is to say then that there is indeed another group of persons who also needs us. And that's the group of people we could call Congregation C, which is really the community in which you live. In other words, what I'm trying to get at here is that instead of employing so much of our evangelism efforts on that peripheral group, the people that we think are prime candidates, but who really are, in a sense, inoculated, perhaps we ought to spend more time strategizing about getting out there to the happy pagans all around us. And I'm talking now about probably people who live next door to you. You borrow their lawnmower, they come over and watch TV with you, you may have cookouts together, you may belong to the same Kiwanis Club, you may go hunting together or shopping together, but on Sunday morning, you go to church and they go to the shore or to the mountains or sleep late or something else. They are all those happy, busy, here and now people that seem to have no interest in the church, and if you talk to them about religion, they'll simply say, well, that might be nice, but frankly, we just don't have the time. He's saying by that, thanks, but no thanks. What do you do then? Well, first, don't panic. And don't take them seriously. I had an illuminating experience once. You get this invoker business a lot, you know. We're having a meeting of the such and such, and would you come along and give an invocation? And they put you at the end of the table, and you trot up and say an invocation at the beginning of the meal, and then you sit through some long program. Well, I did that, done that many times, and I remember doing it once, and the speaker was a psychologist. And he got up and he talked on, I forget what the subject was even, but it was something to do with psychiatry, actually. And at the end of the presentation, we were all trooping down off the stage, and I happened to be walking next to him, making some typical pastoral remark about, you know, very interesting talk, stuff like that, just passing the time. And this man came up, just ready to burst. And he said, are you the doctor who made that talk? The fellow said, why, yes. He said, well, I want to tell you, I think it was all a bunch of baloney. Oh, he said, why did you think that? Well, because you guys are just in some kind of a racket. You make people feel guilty just so you can try to make them feel good again. I thought, boy, Doc, let's see how you handle this one. And you can bet what he said. He said, you seem to feel rather strongly about that. And so the guy went on, you know. He said, it's just all a bunch of witchcraft, black magic. You people are just milking the public for their funds. He said, it's all hoodwinking us. Bunch of bosh. Went on and on this way, you know. And I'm standing there, yes, yeah, well, I'm sorry you feel like that. That's right, and so on. Well, of course, what happened was, finally the guy spouted off everything he had and was done and turned on his heel and walked away. And the psychiatrist said to me, you know, that fella really ought to see a psychiatrist. And I thought to myself, why can't I be that confident about my faith when someone attacks it? Why can't I say, boy, that guy has really got a religious problem? Why do I immediately leap to God's defense and try to solve all his problems right there at the edge of the tables before we leave the dining hall? Why don't I have the sense enough to hear that kind of attack or that kind of sort of flip dismissal of religion as a symbol or sign of something deeper? You know, if you look at those people who are so happy and so busy and living in the here and now, maybe their activity or their hyperactivity is really saying something. Maybe it's a kind of cry for help. I think about all the time people spend in leisure activities these days. Have you ever thought of that as being a symptom for a hidden hunger, a hunger for freedom? Or let's call it simply newness, because the way most people experience freedom is a break in routine. Well, kids call it kicks, huh? They want to get out of the usual routine, so they'll do almost anything for kicks. And isn't it in a sense an inner cry to assure themselves that their career, their future, their school year, their weekly round of class schedules, that's not all there is, that there is still some freshness, some surprises, some freedom at the heart of things. I think it's the same reason that impels people to gamble, that they get fascinated with the possibility that things may not come out the way they always have. You know, There's always a chance that the next spin of the wheel or the next time you pull the lever or the next turn of the card and something really great, surprising, and different will happen. As sporting events the same way. Why are people so committed to sports? Maybe it's because if you live in a 9-to-5 office routine or a 5-to-9 farm routine or whatever it may be, you crave the possibility for newness. And a sporting event is one of those places where the event is not predetermined. You don't know how things are going to come out, and therefore it's exciting. Maybe you've been in the military and have seen heard rebroadcasts of games for which you've already read the results. You know that it's just not the same as watching a game, the outcome of which is not yet assured. I think people go fishing. I think people go hunting for the same kind of assurance. I mean, there's lots of other things that go on as well, in the open air and the relation to nature and the battle of wits and all the rest. But I think at the heart of it, there is still this feeling of the hunger for the surprise. Maybe this is the time I'll get the big one or the biggest one. Human beings are just kind of pre-wired. We are the only animal that laughs. And have you ever thought, what makes us laugh? The unexpected. The reason we laugh at jokes is that they surprise us. And there's something in us that just delights in that. I guess you all know the old story about the Norwegian hunters. I hesitate to tell a Norwegian story in this august presence because you've heard them all. But they went hunting and they shot the buck and started pulling the car and couldn't get him through the woods. So somebody said, well, if you pull them by the antlers instead of by the tail, it'd be a lot easier. So they started that and said, hey boy, this really works better. And the other guy said, yeah, but we're getting farther from the car. That's not new. See, you laugh. Okay, that's a perfect example of surprise. The people that aren't laughing, the ones who heard it before, so it was no surprise to them, and it wasn't a bit funny. That's why a joke is only good as long as it's new, as it's fresh, surprises us. So there's something in us, isn't there, that just craves that. And one of the reasons that folks around us are so busy entertaining themselves, perhaps, is simply a cry for newness in life, for novelty, and ultimately a hunger for freedom. Okay, or take the busy folks. Now, I'm not talking about the people that are busy going hunting or fishing or gambling or recreation one sort or another. I'm talking now about folks who are holding two jobs or who hold one job at work at it day and night, and some of you are right here in this room. Have you ever thought about that compulsion to work and to earn money, not just as greed, but in large part as a hunger for love? That is, you know, I'm not talking about love now in the sense of the June Moon Croon Spoon stuff and all that. I'm talking about the feeling that I am important to somebody. Remember how today started with a child being put in our midst and a conversation about trust, being trusting as a child? We heard then that all our lives we are dependent on God. I'd like to say also that's true, but there's a deep sense in which all of our lives we are still little Monicas. We are still little children. There's in every one of you who sit here, many of you balder than I am, older than I am, there is in every one of you a little kid, little boy, little girl. And there are times in your life when you just want to be that little boy, that little girl again, to be have somebody to take care of you. That's what I mean now when I'm talking about a hunger for love, the feeling that there is somebody who really cares for me and will take care of me. And I mean that on the most basic human level. And if you don't have that opportunity in your life, or if you've had it and no longer have it, you know what I'm talking about. That feeling can then generate all kinds of energy to do things, to be important, to get things done so that somebody will care, so that somebody will say, this office just couldn't go without her. You know? Or, you know, this church just wouldn't be the same if you weren't here doing that job, or whatever it is. And so we work and work. Our friends do the same thing, earn a lot of money. The money is another symbol for the fact I'm important to somebody. They're willing to pay me lots of money to do this job. I must be important. And that can get also, you see, festering inside, so that soon we lose even the goal. We forget that we're looking for love. The teachers have discovered that young people, kids, will often misbehave in class. You know, why? Because they want attention. It's a poor substitute for love, but it's coming out of that same thing. They want to be important to somebody, and if they can't get it legitimately, then they'll misbehave to get it. That's how deep this hunger for love is. It's just like the hunger for freedom. It makes us tell jokes. The hunger for love can make us even misbehave in order to get attention. Think of people who try to get attention in the public press by all kinds of public crimes. Isn't it partly a cry for the same love? I had a friend who worked at the Atlanta Psychiatric Clinic, and he said, we see hundreds of cases every day, but almost every one of them has only one problem. They are screaming inside, somebody love me. It's a hunger for love, and it shows itself often in a thirst for busyness. Or take another one. This business about secularity, as we call it, living in the here and now, never wanting to consider any world other than our own. These, you know, the folks say, well, one world's enough for me. It's got enough trouble here, not worry about heaven or hell or anything else, or God up there. Just live in this world. Have you ever thought of that comment or that attitude as a hunger for security, as a misdirected search for assurance? I flew on Braniff Airlines for the first, may they rest in peace, some years ago. I flew on Braniff for the first time. Turned out to be, I guess, the last time if you look at it. I don't know. But they had clocks on their planes in those days. I'd never ridden on a plane with a clock before. Eastern Airlines, which I was used to using, would never dare put a clock in an airplane. But there it was. I was impressed. It was one of those laboratory clocks. No numbers, you know, just the black lines and the white face with the black hands. Just stark, severe, precise. I got on, looked at my watch, set it. I was sitting in economy class there, up fairly close to the bulkhead, and the clock was right up there above me. I synchronized watches, and we took off. You know how they have that curtain that separates you from the promised land in the... Well, after they had, you know, cleared up the napkins and taken away the champagne glasses and everything in first class, and they pull a curtain back, and they had a clock in first class. Same clock as we had, same kind. Only theirs was 3 minutes faster. And boy, you know, talk about existential shock. Suddenly, whose clock is right? I'd set my watch. I looked at the other one, and you try to rationalize. I said, well, they're first class, so get there sooner. Maybe that's why it's quicker. No, well, that won't work. So finally, I backed off, and I simply made a decision. I said, I'm in this cabin. I'll go by this clock. It was the only way to make sense out of my world, was to just cut out that alternate time. Okay? I don't think I have to draw the parallel too much, do I? People confronted by a reality that's too complex for them, that's too big, tend to pull in their borders to build themselves a world small enough so that it will not have ambiguity. Forget about first class. We'll go by this clock and believe there is none other. So we deny death and dying. We call evil bad luck. We buy all risk insurance, which protects us against everything significantly but acts of God. And, you know, we buy into the pension plan. We try every way possible to be sure that that our world is small enough to control, and we forget about all those immensities out there that we cannot deal with because they're simply too big for us. See what's happened? In that hunger for security, instead of being able to find it, people pull in their borders till they get a world they can control. Now let's just review what we've been saying here. There's a story in the Old Testament about Jacob and Esau. You remember the story? And Esau comes in from the hunt, and he's famished because he didn't bring anything home. And Jacob has been cooking up this lentil soup. And so Esau is so hungry that he sells his birthright for lentil soup. And I'm saying that the people that we know, that we see every day, are essentially Esau's. That is, that they have made a bargain. They're hungry. And they've sold their birthright for something less. Hungry for newness, they've sold their birthright of freedom for kicks. Hungry for importance, they've sold their birthright of love for attention, busyness. Hungry for security, for assurance, they've sold their birthright of security and settled for control. And the tragedy is, see, they're still hungry. So they stay busy, they keep going to the ball games, and they keep their world as small as possible. Now, who needs us? They need us. They need us maybe not to come at them with, "You ought to go to church," but maybe to come at them first with the understanding of what's going on in their lives. And we know because we feel some of that too. And they need us to know well enough as Christians that we have something to feed their hunger. If you look at the miracles of Jesus and don't think of them as proofs of divinity, perhaps you'll discover in them the message of newness, of freedom. Because it seems to me if you look at those miracles, the one thing they're trying to say is things don't have to be the way they are. Social ostracism is changed. The course of an illness is reversed. A lifelong congenital defect is cured. The dead are raised. All of the frontiers, all the limits, all the barriers that say things can't change are, in one sense or another, penetrated by the miracles of Christ. The miracles, then, are a kind of constant reminder that freedom is still our birthright and that life can be different. The parables, they deal with lots of different things, of course, but there are many of those parables that come back to the same theme. You think of the sheep, the 90 and 9, you think of the lost coin, you think of the swallow, the sparrows, the lilies of the field. The parables so often say, in many ways, you are important. They address the fact that our hunger for love can be met, that we are not only dependent on God like children, but more importantly, we are loved by God like children. And security. If the miracles talk about freedom, the parables talk about love, it seems to me that Christ's ministry, and particularly his death and resurrection, talk about security. They say, you don't have to control your life. You can leave it open to the immensities, the enormities, the terrors, the risks, the lonelinesses, and that you will survive, that God will be there, that his security is deeper than any of the challenges that otherwise can terrify us. That kind of deep security, which is not a security from death, even, but a security that's ultimately our lives are in God's hands. So we have something to offer these people, I think. I think they need us more than they know, these Esau's that live next door to us and down the street. What do they need? I think they need the full-orbed message of God, which we know but sometimes don't value highly enough. They need freedom. we can speak to them of God the Spirit, who sets us free to the glorious liberty of the children of God. They need love. We can talk to them about God the Son, who came because we were so important, that God would not leave us without an advocate and a redeemer. They talk about security. And we can talk to them about God the Father, in whose hands our lives will always lie, here and hereafter. They need us, not for who we are. They need us for the same reason that we need the gospel, because we too are Esau's. But in the degree that we recognize both our need and our message, God can use us. May He do that for you and for me.